We are now in the second book of Samuel, at the very beginning chapter 1 of book 2. Originally Samuel was one book, but scrolls are unwieldy, and so they chopped it up into two, and that's why you have 1st and 2nd Samuel. If you don't have the text, please sit next to someone who does, and the person who has it must share in the spirit of Kafka writing a letter to... what, do you think you're better than Kafka? I don't know what book you have, so I can't tell you. I don't know what page. The second book of Samuel, just go to Samuel 2. Right, first chapter. But, okay, page 195, chapter 1, rather, unless you have this, the book of David. This is what's called in the Tanakh resumptive repetition. That is, it brings you back into the story, as we did last week when we reviewed up to here, and it happened after the death of Saul. So now you can place it temporally. This is what's going on, and it's right after Saul dies. When David returned from striking down Amalek, that David stayed in Ziklag 2 days. Now you remember the striking down Amalek was that David went off, that these Amalekites took all of the hostages and all of the booty and so on, and David went with his men and recovered everything. So he stays in Ziklag for 2 days, and it happened on the third day that, look, a man was coming from camp from Saul, his clothes torn and earth on his head. What does that mean? Clothes torn and earth on your head?
In mourning, right.
Those are both signs of mourning, so it lets you know already that someone died. It happened when he came to David, he fell to the ground and did obeisance. So there are two things about this. First of all, it lets you know how you greet a king. You fall to the ground, but also it's a signal that David is now king. Because that already lets you know, if you're treating him as a king, that there's no more competing regimes, because he's not beneficially king as long as Saul is alive. And David said to him, "From where do you come?" Now, I do wonder if David already knows, because the guy fell down. So it's possible that David's playing out a scene here. He doesn't want to say, "Oh, does this mean Saul's dead?" And he said, "From the camp of Israel I've gotten away." And David said to him, "What has happened? Pray tell me." And he said, "The troops fled from the battle, and also many of the troops have fallen and died, and also Saul and Jonathan, his son, died." Now you've got to figure that David has competing emotions here. There's relief and joy and sadness, all of it. Relief and joy because Saul has been persecuting him and because he's now king. It almost reminds you, and I think I've mentioned this before, but if I haven't, I will anyway, of the Jewish law about when a rich parent dies. You know, when someone dies, you say, "Baruch Dayan Emet, blessed be the righteous judge," affirming God's justice even at a time of grief. And there is an all-purpose blessing for when something good happens called Baruch HaTov V'Hametiv, blessed is God who is good and does good, whenever something good happens. If a rich parent dies that you know is going to leave you money, the halakha is first you say Baruch HaTov HaMeitiv, blessed who is good and does good, because you just inherited. And you know that you're going to feel inside of yourself some joy despite the fact that you don't want to, because you just got rich. So you say that, you get it out of the way, you don't have to feel guilty about it, and then you say Baruch Dayan Emet. So your grief can be real, as opposed to saying, "You know, I said Baruch Dayan Emet, but part of me was happy." Which is very wise, actually. And so David has to have, I mean, we're all at least, there's a story that was actually unfortunately later disproven, that it was proved that it was made up of a meeting between Dickens and Dostoevsky, where Dostoevsky said to Dickens that he had two people inside him, and Dickens said, "Only two." So even though unfortunately it doesn't seem to be true, there was a long, actually investigative piece about it in the Times Literary Supplement about who first wrote the story and whether they made it up. But it's true. I mean, everybody has multiple people in them. And the part of you that, you know, inherited is happy. So I'm assuming David has lots of... And David said to the lad who was telling him, "How do you know that Saul died and Jonathan, his son?" So his first reaction is to verify the information, which... I suppose, is natural, but also is a little bit cool-headed. I don't know. I'm not sure. Anyway, and the lad who was telling him said, I chanced to be on Mount Gilboa, and look, Saul was leaning on his spear, and look, chariots and horsemen had overtaken him. And he turned around behind him and saw me and called to me and said, here I am. And he said to me, who are you? And I said, here I am. And he said to me, who are you? And I said to him, I'm an Amalekite. And he said to me, pray, stand over me and finish me off. For the fainting spell has seized me, for while life is still within me. And I stood over him and finished him off, for I knew that he couldn't live after having fallen. Now, go back and take a look at what happened, because that's not what happened according to the text. Look at chapter 31 of the previous book of Samuel 1, which you should all have. Just go back a page or two. And meanwhile, the Philistines were battling against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines, and they fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. Right? They're not even mentioned to David, but he is. What's that?
Before Saul.
And the battle went heavy against Saul, and the archers and the bowmen found him, and he quaked with fear of the archers. And Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and run me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and run me through and abuse me. We can only imagine what they would do with Saul's body. But the armor bearer didn't want to do it because he was very frightened. And Saul took the sword and fell upon it. And the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead. So in fact, Saul kills himself. Because the omniscient narrator doesn't lie. You know, at least that's the assumption. That his characters lie, but the author doesn't lie. He tells you what happened in the context of the story, so Saul committed suicide. Now, he committed suicide like 5 minutes before he was going to be killed, so it's not suicide in the normal sense. That is, you know, there was no doubt. It wasn't like they were going to come upon him and say, ah, let's spare him. There was no doubt he was about to be killed. His sons had just been killed, and he didn't want to be killed by the Philistines. He would rather be killed by himself or by his armor bearer. But nonetheless, this is one of those rare times when we know, it happens a couple times in the Torah, but it happens actually with the report of Eliezer when he sees Rebekah at the well and then reports in detail. And the report differs slightly from what actually happens. Here, it differs a lot. Saul actually kills himself, but the Amalekite comes to David and says, I killed him. Why? Because obviously he's expecting David to say, I will now lavish gifts on you for killing my enemy. But that's, as I wrote, I actually put this in the book, we'll see if it stays. I said, this is the peril of not knowing what book you're in. Because if the Amalekite had known that he was in the book of Samuel, he would have realized that every single time someone comes to David and says, I killed an enemy of yours, what does David do? He kills them. Always, always. Well, it happens like 5 or 6 times in the book. So the Amalekite doesn't know what we know, which is you never come to David and say, I killed an enemy of yours because you're going to die. And you understand why that is, by the way. It has lots of benefits for David and no benefit for him to reward it, which if this were a smarter guy, he would have realized. David, by killing the Amalekite, one, looks like he doesn't want Saul to die and is angry that Saul died and angry at the person who did it. And two, if there's any kind of lingering conspiracy that David gave away Saul's position to the Philistine or in any way whispered to someone, you know, if Saul died, he also, the secret goes to the grave with whoever did it, if this guy was in any kind of collusion. Because remember, he approaches David, but David's not alone. There are other people standing around David. A king never is just standing there, or a prospective king, you know, hanging out in the middle of nowhere. So David's men are watching how he reacts too. And I stood over him. I'm now back on verse 10, chapter 1. And I stood over him and finished him off, for I knew that he couldn't live after having fallen. And I took the diadem, that is the crown, that may be a more accurate word, but what does it have in the JPS, crown? I think, which is natural in translators, Alter uses a different word than the JPS because he wants to use a different word. Otherwise, why have a different translation? But crown, that was on his head, and the band that was on his arm, and I've brought them here to my Lord. Now that's also, I mean, is David happy to have them? Probably. Does David want to show that he's happy to have them? Of course not. And David took hold of his garments and tore them. So the first thing he does is the ancient sign of mourning by tearing your clothes. And all the men who were with him did so too. So everybody tears their garments. Everybody. Now, the men who are with him are just as happy as the cabinet members when their president gets elected, right? They're happy too. But they also know that the forms have to be observed, and a king of Israel died. The first king of Israel died. And so you tear your clothes, and that's the only appropriate thing to do. And they keened, and they wept, and they fasted till evening, which, you know, let's see, what time is it now? Okay, for the next 3 hours, nobody eat anything. Then we'll have a feast. No, I don't know. I don't know what time. It doesn't say what time he came to him, does it? It doesn't say, like, early in the morning or anything. No, anyway, it just says on the third day. But till evening, all right, look. And also, by the way, remember, in all seriousness, that Saul has repeatedly tried to kill David. So it's not like, you know, he tried to beat him in an election. David has good reason to really have deep, and so did David's men, who protected him, and they were responsible for Saul's not killing him. I mean, that was their responsibility in part. They have a lot of reason for joy that Saul is not there anymore. So we have to take that into account, even though they won't say it, or and the text won't say it. And David said to the lad who told him, "From where are you?" And he said, "The son of an Amalekite sojourner am I." Now also, remember, David bears no love to the Amalekites, just killed a whole Amalekite troop, and Amalek is, in the Bible, the traditional enemy of Israel. So, and David said to him, "How were you not afraid to reach out your hand to do violence to the Lord's anointed?" Remember also, it's a very good practice for successors to defend the integrity of their predecessors. Because once killing kings becomes common, David also. Right, then he's in trouble, exactly. So that's, I'm sure, although I haven't read the Caro biography and I know nothing about it, but I'm sure that for his entire presidency, LBJ had to worry about assassins. How could you not? So I'll finish the chapter and then I'll take comments. And David said, "How are you not afraid to reach out your hand to do violence to the Lord's anointed?" And David called to one of the lads and said, "Come forward, stab him." Now, obviously, I mean, it sounds very cavalier, but I also assume that that's exactly what David would do, and David wouldn't, I don't think he would sully his hands by killing an Amalekite lad by himself. That is, that's what you have henchmen for, to do that kind of work for you. But I always liked this part. And he struck him down and he died. Okay? So he's dead. And David said to him. In other words, he said to his corpse, right? "Your blood is on your own head, for your mouth bore witness against you, saying, 'I was the one who finished off the Lord's anointed.'" Now, who's David saying that for? Right, obviously. He's not saying it for the Amalekite, because the Amalekite's not going to say, "Oh, you're right, by the way. Now I get it." And David sang this lament for Saul and for Jonathan. And he said to teach hard things to the sons of Judah, for look, it is written down in the book of Yashar. Now let me stop there for a minute. The book of Yashar is one of those books that is mentioned in the Tanakh that we don't have anymore. But we know that there were other books, because both in the Torah and also later, it said in the book of this or that, and we don't have those books. So there was a book called Yashar that is unfortunately lost to history, and it contained this lament of David for Saul and Jonathan. Okay, so before we get to the lament, because this is a kind of natural break, any questions about the narrative part of the, yes? Is it possible? I wouldn't say anything is not possible, but it would have mentioned it, presumably, in the narrative. It would have said the guy, and then he was finished off by this guy. Right, but it doesn't say that. It says he fell down and he died. So, yeah.
Is it possible that
Oh, I'm sure that it made it easier to kill him that he was an Amalekite. But David has done this multiple times and is still to do it multiple times, as you will see, which is when someone kills an enemy of his, he kills them. So it's not when Yoav kills Abner later on at the end of the, as David is dying, he tells Solomon basically, be sure you kill Yoav. So David even carries this, he carries this vengefulness beyond the grave. It's very, it's curious, you know, you don't know to what extent this is a principle with him and to what extent he really kills the Amalekite because he's infuriated that an Amalekite would kill a king of Israel and to what extent it's a pragmatic calculation. You can't know. But there's every reason for David to kill this guy, every reason, and no reason to let him stay alive so that he could go around bragging, I killed the king of Israel. I mean, why should he let him do that? He's just an Amalekite. They're a dime a dozen, you know? So, but seriously, I mean, he's specifically from the least savory tribe in the world as far as the Israelites are concerned. So why leave him alive? Yeah. I'm sure.
But he can't show that.
So he kills the Amalekite.
And he puts it onto
It gives one more motivation. Yes. Well, we're about to see David's anguish, actually. But we haven't seen it yet. Yeah.
Was there any law of amnesty in the Torah at some point that if someone comes to the king?
There's a law of amnesty for accidental killings. But there's not a law of amnesty for murder. Mm-hmm. No. The king can, but not for murder. That's what I'm saying. Murder is a capital crime, and the king ought not to spare someone for committing murder against someone else, because then the offense isn't against the king.
Even in which case that Saul acted.
If you're saying, did David have to, according to law, kill him? I don't think the law is developed enough. David can do what he wants, basically. But he could easily say it's not murder. But first of all, the Amalekite doesn't ask for mercy. Presumably he wasn't given time. And second, I don't think there's any reason for David to give him mercy. He has every reason, as I said, to kill him. Why would he give him mercy?
The reason is because.
Right. Not amnesty even. He's going to be rewarded.
Rewarded.
Right. But why would David do it? It's not in his interest in any way to let this guy live.
And he doesn't look back in front of.
Quite the opposite. I think they were probably, it's exactly what someone who kills a king, regicide, they ought to die. And if another king lets them live, it looks like he wanted the first king to be killed. Very bad publicity. Very bad PR for David to do it. Yeah, Don. Right. Well, no, I understand on a human level why you'd want the guy to live, but on a David level, there's no reason to. I mean, I can make a very good case why, on a human level, sure, the Amalekite should be allowed to live. He thought he was doing a good thing, etc. But look at it from David's point of view. So that this guy who killed Saul is in David's court. But think of how it's going to play in Israel. Did you know that David brought the guy who killed Saul into his court? It's not going to play well. You know that. And not only is it not going to play well that David does this, but not only is it not going to play well that David does this, but in addition, if you think about it, David's enemies aren't going to think very much of him either. Right? Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. I don't know why, something about this room that I'm allergic to. Could be the Torah. I mean, seriously though, it's not going to play well among David's enemies either. That he all of a sudden to somebody kills the king and David takes them into his court. It looks very unsavory. You know, I really don't think that David had much choice here. One sec. Yeah.
Right. I was just going to add to
Right.
I will not be weak. I will not be indecisive. I will take immediate action.
I'm going to bomb Syria right away. Thank you. All right. I heard that. I heard that. Yes. No, Ten Commandments prohibit murder, not killing. So the question is this murder, is it not murder? But by the way, but the question stands because you also see a lot of murder. Nobody who reads the history of Israel is under any illusions that it works according to the Ten Commandments. It doesn't. I mean, it's like watching Game of Thrones. It really is. It's ancient tribes trying their best. I mean, look, when God who says, thou shalt not murder, tells Moses, when the people go into Canaan, kill men, women, and children. Now, in Joshua, they don't really do it. The interesting thing is, the Torah in practice is less bloodthirsty than the Torah in principle. That is, when they go into Canaan, they don't, by and large, kill men, women, and children. But David, as we've seen, has done that in villages where he doesn't want the word to get back to other people that he... Anyway, that was a complicated story from the first... Samuel, but remember, David doesn't want the king to know that he's not killing Israelites. So he, when he raids other villages, he kills men, women, and children so that nobody is alive to go back and tell the king. So yeah, there's a lot of, you know, highly questionable stuff. Yeah. The lad said he's an Amalekite stranger. Aren't we supposed to welcome the stranger? Yes, he welcomed him. Welcome. Come on in. There are two responses to that. The first is that there are competing principles here. He's not just a stranger. He's also a stranger who claims to have killed a king. So that already takes you out of the category of stranger. And second, if you apply the principles of everyday conduct to David throughout his life, you will find innumerable instances where he doesn't fulfill those principles. I mean, I'm not even talking about David and Bathsheba, which we will come to, in which, you know, obviously he doesn't fulfill those principles. But also, you can't be the king of a tribe in an ancient warring culture and survive according to the way that you survive doing business in Westwood. You just can't. That's the reality of it. One last comment and then we'll go to the poetry. Right. It's true. His lie got him killed. Right. So actually the lesson is don't lie. That tells you something about it, which is that he was proud of his action because he actually lied about it. And by the way, David doesn't seem to know that he lied. Maybe never knows that he lied, but he lied about it, and that tells you what his attitude was and the way he probably said it to David, which is with pride. One of the weird things that actually occurs to me, and you know is true, is so much of our reaction to what someone says depends on how they say it, and you can't tell that from the printed word. You just can't. I mean, haven't you ever walked out of a conversation and said, their manner is so irritating. But you don't know why. It just struck you that way, even though if you put what they said on a printed page, you would say, that's reasonable, that makes sense. So who knows with what kind of attitude the Amalekite said this. And if you're a king and you have people's lives at your whim, you know, it's very easy to dispatch them, yeah. We don't know when they were written, but the chances are that they were written, if not in David's lifetime, soon after David, because they're clearly written to support the Davidic line of kingship. So at least a few hundred years, in the few hundred years following David, because after that it was irrelevant, in the few hundred years following David, they were written. And also there's so much of what seems like primary documentation that it probably wasn't that far away from the events, because the author knows a lot about the detail and texture and so on about those events. So maybe it was a court historian in the time of David or Solomon, which is what a lot of people think. We don't know for sure. Okay. So remember, David has a reputation as a poet. We know this. And one of the reasons that David has that reputation is this poem. The splendor, O Israel, on your heights lies slain. How have the warriors fallen? Now also, I want to point out, it's not like the Amalekites said they died and David just burst into poetry, right? He's had time to think about it. They fasted all day, and then he, you know, so it's plausible, first of all, that this really is David's poem. There's no reason why not. It's not like every king in Israel all of a sudden bursts into poetry. Why do they put poetry in the mouth of David? And second, these kinds of formal laments are very common in the ancient world, and they're very much like a eulogy today, which is you don't say it's not sincere because it took him 2 days to write the eulogy. Not at all. It has to do with the content. Sometimes to put what you feel into words and to do it accurately and well takes more time rather than less time, and there's no reason to think that David's words are insincere just because they're in the form of poetry and they took him a while to bring them forth. The splendor, O Israel, on your heights lies slain. How have the warriors fallen? Al tagidu begat, which is a beautiful line. Tell it not in gat, is the way that it is in the Hebrew. I should have brought the Hebrew for this, and maybe I will next time. But gat, of course, is a Philistine city. It's the Philistine capital. And the idea of don't tell it in gat means exactly what David has just demonstrated, which is he doesn't want it celebrated among the enemies of Israel that Saul has died. So one of the pains of this is that he knows that it will bring joy to the enemies of Israel that the king of Israel has died. Proclaim it not in Ashkelon's streets, lest the Philistine daughters rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised gloat. Now, there is also in Hebrew poetry, which you don't get in fact, you know what, I'm going to read the whole thing, then somebody read it in the JPS translation too, and then I'll talk about the, O hills of Gilboa, no dew and no rain fall upon you, O lofty fields, for there the warrior's shield was besmirched, the shield of Saul unburnished with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the warrior's fat, Jonathan's bow did not retreat, and the sword of Saul never turned away empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and dear in their life and their death, they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles and stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and bangles, who studded your garments with jewelry of gold. How have the warriors fallen in the midst of battle? Jonathan, upon your height slain, I grieve for you, my brother Jonathan. Very dear were you to me, more wondrous your love to me than the love of women. How have the warriors fallen and the gear of battle is lost? Jamie, would you read the JPS translation?
Your glory, O Israel, lies slain on your heights. How have the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, do not proclaim in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistine rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. O hills of Gilboa, let there not be dew or rain on you, or bountiful fields. For there the shield of warriors lay rejected, the shield of Saul, polished with oil no more. From the blood of slain, from the fat of warriors, the bow of Jonathan never turned back, the sword of Saul never withdrew empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and cherished, never parted in life or in death. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. Daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in crimson and finery, who decked your robes with jewels of gold. How have the mighty fallen in the thick of battle, Jonathan slain on your heights. I grieve for you, my brother Jonathan. You were most dear to me. Your love was wonderful to me, more than the love of women. How have the mighty fallen? The weapons of war perished.
So please go ahead. Let's hear a third. You can't have too many renditions of poetry and translation. Marion, please read it.
Thy beauty, O Israel, upon thy high places is slain. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest as the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew nor rain upon you, neither fields of choice fruits. For there the shield of the mighty was vilely cast away, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, the lovely and the pleasant, in their lives, even in their death, they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? Jonathan, upon thy high places is slain. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Wonderful was thy love to me, passing the love of women. How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished?
Whose translation is that? That's not King James.
Real old,
but it's not. It's the JPS 1917. That's what it is. Okay.
Like
yeah.
That.
Okay. So you got the idea, I hope. And also, it reminds you that translations are very variable. You know that really you can't get, especially poetry in translation, properly. It's like kissing through a veil, was the way Bialik put it. But let's start at the beginning. The splendor, O Israel, on your heights light slain, how have the warriors fallen? Remember that the warriors were in the ancient world, the crown of a society, because without them, the society couldn't sustain itself. And in some ways, I think the measure of the degree of civility of a society is the degree to which its soldiers don't matter so much, or maybe the civility of the societies around it. You know, if you're lucky enough to have a society in which the military doesn't matter very much, you're a very lucky country. I remember I went to Costa Rica and they don't have an army. I thought, what a lucky country to not have to have an army, really. But in the ancient world, obviously, you needed an army very badly. By the way, in modern Israel, the primacy of the army and how important the army is lets you know how unfortunate the country is. You know, it wouldn't have to have such an important army if they weren't surrounded by such unsavory characters. Let's just put it that way. Now, these days, unsavory characters in meltdown, which is even better. Tell it not in Gath, and I said, proclaim it on Ashkelon streets. You don't want your enemies to cheer. Lest the Philistine daughters rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised gloat. Now, this is where I stopped last time, because I wanted to explain Hebrew poetry works by something that English poetry doesn't use, which is called parallelism. And in parallelism, what you do is you say the same thing twice in different words. So, lest the Philistine daughters rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised gloat, that's the same sentiment, right? But it's said in different words, and therefore is supposed to have a slightly different nuance. And Hebrew poetry works by what's called both by chiasm, which you don't see here, but I'll explain another time when we do, and this parallelism, in which you say things the same way, but in two different... O hills of Gilboa, no dew and no rain upon you, O lofty fields. In other words, and we see this also, again, it's in W.H. Auden, has this beautiful funerary poem, which you might have heard, or if you've ever seen the movie Four Weddings and a Funeral, it actually plays a central role in that, where he talks about the stars going out and the sun not shining. It's you want nature to reflect the sadness that you feel, right? Because if you've ever had a terrible loss in your life, one of the things that's shocking is that the world doesn't change. And you feel like it should. You don't understand how is it that the sun's coming up the way it does every other day, and people are going about their business as though they don't realize that the world just crashed and burned. But that's the reality of it. So in poetry, he's explaining that feeling that, you know, like everything should... Oh, thank you. Thank you. That everything should be different from the way that it is. For there the warrior's shield was besmirched. In other words, was degraded, was ruined, and the shield of Saul unburnished with oil. That's what you used to do with your shield. You would put oil on it. Why? So that when somebody struck it, it would slide off. So once your shield is unpolished, that means it's not fending off weapons anymore. Well, it won't go in smoother. No, the shield won't go in smooth. It's the shield, not the rest. You could polish your sword as well, but this is just the shield. From the blood of the slain, from the warrior's fat, Jonathan's bow did not retreat, and the sword of Saul never turned away empty. In other words, they always succeeded in killing the people that they were trying to kill. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and dear in their life and in their death, they were not parted. So not only were they close in life, which we know is not always true, since Saul once wanted to kill Jonathan, which kind of can cause a breach, but in their death, but that doesn't work for eulogy and poetry. Do you know what a lapidary inscription is? A lapidary inscription, lapidary is on stone. In other words, the inscription that you put on a gravestone. So Samuel Johnson famously said, in lapidary inscriptions, one is not upon oath. In other words, you don't have to say the exact truth when you write something on someone's gravestone. So the same thing in eulogies. In eulogies, you don't have to be dishonest, but you don't have to, you know, say, Saul and Jonathan had their problems. Also, that's not good poetry. Beloved and dear in their life and their death, they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles and stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel. Now, this is a contrast with the daughters of the Philistines. The daughters of the Philistines are going to gloat over Saul. The daughters of Israel should weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and bangles, who studded your garments with jewelry of gold. There's a lot of commentary. He may have it here. He doesn't exactly say it, but about what did Saul literally, like, provide the daughters of Israel with finery and garments? And it probably alludes to, you know, when you win in battle, you take stuff and you give it to your people. So maybe he quite literally did that from the battles that he had won. How have the warriors fallen in the middle of battle? Jonathan, upon your height slain, I grieve for you, my brother Jonathan. Very dear were you to me, more wondrous your love to me than the love of women. How have the warriors fallen and the gear of battle is lost? Now, I want to two things about Jonathan. First of all, you can feel that David's emotional connection to Jonathan by the words he says is deeper than Saul, right? He talks about Jonathan in a different way from Saul. Saul is, Israel should weep because he was a great warrior. Jonathan is, he was dear to me. Now, the second is the homosexual question about Jonathan and David, which is very much discussed, and I'll give you my two cents about it, which again, I had to figure out what it was that I thought, because I was writing it in the book. So here's what I think. You certainly can understand how somebody could read a homosexual subtext into this. It's easy, right? Your love surpassed the love of women. So it's easy to see how he's talking about a homosexual connection. But I think it's actually on balance unlikely for two reasons. The first is emotional terms that men use for one another are very common in history. You see them in Shakespeare all the time with no homoerotic subtext. Men used to speak very emotionally about other men until people started to read homosexual subtext, and then they stopped. So now men are much more skittish about saying, I love him dearly, than they used to be. In the 18th century, the 17th century, you see it all the time. So an emotional comment about another man doesn't necessarily mean that. And in fact, he could love Jonathan more than he's loved any of the women in his life. David is not notable for the way in which he's loved women in his life, and it could have nothing to do with. But the second reason why it seems unlikely, which I don't think Alter mentions, but other people have said, is if in fact biblical culture, and as far as we know this is true, if biblical culture was clearly anti-homosexual activity, then would the author of this have put this in if he thought it was going to be interpreted as homosexual activity, when, after all, the whole book is trying to portray David in as good a light as possible? So I can see the argument both ways, and you can't prove it one way or the other. And if you're trying to make a case for homosexuality in the Bible, this is probably the best text you've got. But I think it's very easy to see that it's not actually the likeliest, interpretation, even though it's a possible one. The last point that I want to make about it is, this is very David, in that there is no place in the entire story of David where he says he loves anyone. Nowhere. And here, notice what he says. Your love was dearer to me than the love of women. He doesn't say, my love for you was greater than my love for women. He doesn't say that. He says, your love for me, because David loves to be loved. But that doesn't, and that's what David's name means. It means beloved, but it doesn't mean lover. And David doesn't seem, I won't say that. It doesn't mean, because David is never said to love, it doesn't mean that he can't love. But it does certainly strike you that David is talked about as being loved by Michal, by Jonathan, by Saul, but never is said to love someone else. Except in one case, which is really fascinating, that we'll come to, and I'm sure I will repeat this when we come to it, but I'm going to say it now, just because when I came across it in writing the book, I thought it was an amazing, amazing and fascinating thing. Later on, when we come to the story of how Amnon rapes his sister, half-sister, something that I know you'll all be looking forward to, but in fact, that's what happens. So Amnon is David's firstborn, and basically David doesn't punish him for having done that. And the Bible doesn't give a reason why exactly, but the early translation of the Bible, the Septuagint, does. It says, because David loved Amnon. So the question is, first of all, was that originally in the story and did it fall out? Because some things that the Septuagint preserves, we think, were lost from the original manuscript of the Torah, and the Septuagint preserved them in the early translation. Somehow in the copying of the Hebrew it got lost, but now we still have it, fortunately, because the Greek was translated very, very early on, before the Talmud, long, long ago, right? In the time, basically, of the Maccabees. So a long time ago. So maybe it preserved some things that we've since lost, or was it added in order to explain why David didn't punish him? So most scholars assume it was added. And if it was added, then what's interesting is the only mention we have of David loving someone is something that was added because people couldn't stand the thought, first of all, that there was no explanation for David's not punishing, and also that there was nowhere that David was said to love, not even with his own children was he said to love. And by the way, just on trivia, and then I'll take questions, the first mention of love in the Torah is a parent for a child, not a husband for a wife or a wife for a husband. And that's when Abraham is told to sacrifice Isaac. It says, your son whom you love. The first mention of love in the Torah, which is a really interesting thing. Because in some ways if love involves sacrifice, parents do that for children more than any other kind of love. So, okay, there were several hands up, so yeah, go ahead. I'll go across the room.
It's
a great example.
The love for each other that they have is not.
That's a great example.
But it's definitely profound and lasts for a lifetime.
Right. What Don said is he spent time in Vietnam, and he knows that the love that people who go into battle have for one another is not homoerotic, but it's deep and lasts a lifetime. And you can imagine, if you face that kind of peril together, that it's a different kind of love. Yeah. So, yes. I would bet you anything that members of the platoon say, I love you more than I love my wife. Yes, I'll bet you.
Yeah. First mentions like a brother, and then he doesn't make a parable just like the Hebrew poetry that you're claiming.
Right.
Something else.
Yes.
For women.
Yep.
So that's a little suspicious. But on the other hand, in a eulogy, why would David say, mention something that would come out as homosexual?
Unless he didn't think it would. So there are two possibilities. One is everyone knew, so he wasn't ashamed to say it, which is possible. We don't know. Or he figured nobody would interpret it that way because it was common to speak about, you know, people that we were close to. You really can argue it either way, and it's been very cleverly argued both ways. So I'm not taking a firm position. I would never say this is clearly not homoerotic. I think that on balance, I come down and it's probably not, but I'm certainly open, you know, if they found another text tomorrow that said something that would suggest that David and Jonathan were lovers, would I be shocked? No, I wouldn't be shocked.
Two parallels from Homer, Achilles' reaction on
Patroclus' death, right. Right, but I'm sure that it's extremely emotional and weepy and so on. And I actually give a couple of examples in the book of the rhetoric that's used, like Damon and Pythias and other kinds of friendship things. But
yeah. And the other comment is that what you call parallelism, also parallelism, also occurs very often in Homer, very verbose.
Yes.
Almost without exception, describes something again the second time with some very.
There is. Maybe the most interesting literary essay I've ever read, and everybody reads it in rabbinical school, it's a very famous essay by Eric Auerbach in his book Mimesis called Odysseus's Scar. And it compares the verbosity of Homer and the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. It's an amazing, amazing essay. If you're interested in literature at all, it's really worth reading. People still quote it, and it was written, you know, almost 100 years ago. So, yeah.
Two points. One of them, I'm sure, is going to be unpleasant. But if Alice Miller were commenting, she would say David didn't love anybody else because his narcissism absolutely overtook him.
Well, she would say that's a possibility, certainly. Yeah.
But it's so extreme the way you describe it. It is so powerful
right.
that he wouldn't let anybody get that close to him.
Very possible.
So he wouldn't
right.
say it. The other thing is that I understand what's being said about warfare. I've asked you a question some time ago, and you said you'd get to it later. This may be the time. We first meet David when he's a shepherd.
Right.
And he's left alone with the sheep.
Right.
And there's sexual behavior that went on between men and beasts. The Bible prohibits it, so it went on.
Right.
And there was sexual behavior among men who were not necessarily in combat, but were separated from society for long periods of time, 17th and 18th century. Sailors traveling around the world.
Right. Yes, but they're not separated.
No, I understand.
Right.
But groups of men.
Right.
Were there camp followers watching these battles? Were there women?
Well, we know there were women around because remember they have their wives with them because the Amalekites take them. So there were women around. Whether they were around all the time, I don't know. And as for David and sheep, I'm not even going there. I am not going there. But also what you mentioned about Alice Miller, who's the Drama of the Gifted Child writer, that. She would say that he couldn't love because of his narcissism. I would say that that's certainly one of the ways you can read David, and that a certain degree of narcissism seems almost demanded by a degree of such heavily responsible leadership. You know, it's not surprising. How else do you sustain that burden?
How can you protect
yourself? Right, Roberta. But the sheep thing, forget. So you will. There's so much to say about Bathsheba. That's so much to say about Bathsheba. Let's wait till we get there. Okay, it's too. You can't dip a toe into that story. It's too comprehensive. Yeah. Yes, it's a very. That line is probably the most famous line from this poem, "Ech naflu giborim," how the mighty have fallen, and the reason that it's so is in part because. It happens again and again and again. You know, the mighty are always falling. So it's one of those things that has that universal reference. Yes.
I want to ask you about the
It's a nice idea. It's a nice idea that the neshama, that the soul of somebody exists in the person that you name them for. I mean, well, here's what I would say. Sometimes you name someone for someone who died and they resemble them, and sometimes you name someone for someone who died and they don't resemble them at all. So, yeah, there are some things about David that are heroic and there are some things that are somewhat less heroic. So, I will, yeah. Yeah.
Everyone has got
it. Yes, go ahead.
He
doesn't use "how the mighty have fallen," as far as I know, no. But it's a very similar, that's Shelley's poem. Look upon these works, you mighty, in despair. That's what he says, but he doesn't say "how the mighty have fallen."
The other thing that occurred to me while you were talking about David killing everybody was that we tend to look at all of these stories in the context of our own civilization, our own society, and if they had Twitter, he wouldn't have had to kill everybody.
Well, a lot of plots of English novels would collapse with a cell phone. Romeo and Juliet. If he had just texted, you know, never would have died, it would have been fine. It's not so easy to write those kinds of things anymore because so much of literature depends on misunderstanding, misdirection, didn't get there on time, now there's no time, you know? So everything can be done, it's true. Yes, last comment and then we have to finish. Okay, it may be true. We can't know, so we'll have to leave it at it may be true. Before we say the Kaddish, which is, by the way, someone had asked me, the original Kaddish probably was this one, which you said for learning. And the paragraph that seems unfamiliar is Al Yisrael v'Al Rabbanan, on Israel and on their teachers and on their students and on the students of their students. It's all about studying Torah. But before we do, especially because we're here and right out there is Pilot Plaza, I just want you to know that I heard the sad news this morning that Sid Pilot passed away last night. So those of you who know him, and because we're sitting here, it seems appropriate to mention it. I just spoke to Ruth this morning. Okay, please rise.